This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you till 2 p.m. You heard all of the intro music and then a little more from what we usually play between interviews. It doesn't usually go on that long, but I've been having trouble reaching the person I was expecting to interview at this time. It's Greil Marcus, who's one of the editors, along with Werner Solars, of The New Literary History of America, which was published last fall by Harvard University Press. I talked to him about an hour ago at the same number, and I'm not quite sure what happened. He was rather busy when I talked to him before, and it's possible that something has come up. In any case, I gave him this number, and there's a chance that he will call back. In the meantime, though, I'd just like to give some background about this and about the program as a whole. The idea was an American literature program, the first half devoted to the new literary history of the United States, the second to a new biography of Mark Twain by Jerome Loving. It's called Mark Twain, The Adventures of Samuel L. Clemens. And I'll definitely, or I hope definitely, be talking to him in the second half. A New Literary History of America is an immense book. It's how many people in it? I think about 200 topics. It's 1,100 pages in all. It has, I think, 150 authors, because there's some of them repeat on their topics. Some of them write one short essay, some write two, and a number of them even write three. I first came upon this last summer when I was back on the East Coast. I ran into Alex Beam, who is a columnist for the Boston Globe. He's the husband of a cousin of mine. I guess that makes him a cousin-in-law. In any case, he handed this huge tome to me and hoped I would enjoy it. I was a little surprised, and I wanted to get more information about it, and it turned out he'd been given an advance copy of the book with some publicity, which he thought was rather misleading. He wound up writing a column about it in which he described it as wacky and didn't think it was maybe had the academic credentials one might want from it. I took it, opened one essay at random, and was immediately hooked. That essay was the one by Zora Neale Hurston from 1955. She denounced the Supreme Court decision in Brown versus Board of Education, which led to the outlawing of legal segregation in American schools. Her argument was that many black schools and many black communities were finally, after nearly a century of so-called freedom, finally beginning to stand on their own and were developing distinct cultures and distinct sorts of opportunities, which she thought they would lose if black children were just randomly jumbled in with white children. After that, I began reading quite a few of the others. I would say of the entire book, there's 200 essays. I've probably read about 40 or 50 of them completely. Another two-thirds of them I've read in two fairly good extent, and there's probably 80% of them I've read at least a page or so of. The ones, well, I won't try that. I was going to start recommending a few just now. Instead, I'm just going to read some of the topics. One of the things that upset Alex Beam was that Harvard was promoting this as a reference book, and it's very unlike standard histories of American literature that would list all the minor novelists and poets of a particular period, fit them together one way or another, with a fairly consecutive narrative. This one jumps around with little, essentially, snapshots. I'll just read some of the first ones. 1507, the name America appears on a map. 1521, Mexico in America. That would be the conquest of Mexico. 1536, the exploits or explorations of Álvaro Núñez Cabeza de Vaca. It goes on and on. Fear and Love in the Virginia Colony. A City Upon a Hill, that's 1630. 1643, A Nearer Neighbor to the Indians. 1666, Anne Bradstreet. 1670, The American Jeremiad, and so on. The tone of the essays varies considerably according to who's involved. There are quite a few well-known authors, some critics, more of them are novelists or poets, and the largest number is academics, most of whom I haven't heard of. But I'll just maybe point out a few of the ones that might particularly be of interest. One of the best ones is Greil Marcus himself writing about Moby Dick, and one of the first things he points out is, in the maybe 10th or 15th page of the novel, a headline or an imaginary newspaper set of headlines which Ishmael concocted in his head while he was wandering around New Bedford getting ready to go on his whaling expedition. And the headlines were, Grand Contested Election for President of the United States, Whaling Voyage by One Ishmael, Bloody Battle in Afghanistan. If you need any convincing that Moby Dick is as relevant today as it was in the 1850s, that might do it for you. Or it might not. There's a lot of seeming coincidences. There's a lot of overlaps, some of which I think are brilliant, some of which are forced. I'm trying to see what some of these are. One author compares Sister Carrie and the House of Mirth, which were written in roughly the same time. I haven't read that one, and I'm not sure how good a job they do of it. Ishmael Reed writes about Huckleberry Finn as Mark Twain's hairball, and then Andre Codrescu writes about New Orleans, all of the history of New Orleans through the years, not just he anchors it in 1885, but it really is a history of writing by and about New Orleans authors from the early 18th century to the present. Another fascinating one is the fact that Faulkner's Absalom Absalom and Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind were published within a few months of each other. And other chapters have to do with things that might not immediately seem literary, but really are or have a strong influence on American literature, such as Alexander's Ragtime Band from 1911, D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation in 1915, Mamie Smith's Crazy Blues in 1920, another comparison of T.S. Eliot and D.H. Lawrence, Eliot being an American who left his country for England, Lawrence being an Englishman who tried to become an American but failed. Another ones include Mickey Mouse, Grant Wood's American Gothic, FDR's First Fireside Chat, The Skyscraper, Alcoholics Anonymous is a particularly fascinating one. And there's more and more. The first issue of Superman, Jelly Roll Morton, Billie Holiday, Preston Sturges. Again and again, they just seem to skirt the edges of what we would normally call literature. They go into music, motion pictures, other forms of popular culture, but they all come back eventually in one way or another to what winds up on the written page. Another one is by Keith Taylor about Hemingway's Paradise, Hemingway's prose. There's several about Hemingway. There's several about Henry James, several about Mark Twain, several about Hemingway, several about Faulkner. And then, strangely, some people are completely omitted or just mentioned in passing. One I didn't particularly care for was Helen Bendler's discussion of Wallace Stevens' collected poems. I found it kind of boring and didn't really have much new to say about it. One I really liked was Mary Gateskill talking about Norman Mailer. I've tried, when I've been leafing through this, it's tempting to look for the famous names. I know that Camille Paglia's in here somewhere. I haven't run across her yet, and I'm trying not to go through the table of contents and go to the essay that she wrote. And there's a number of other well-known people who I have not searched out. There's some who I ran across purely by accident. I'm trying to see one of these here now, and was quite pleased. Well, one of them was the Mary Gateskill writing about Norman Mailer. There's, I can't quite see the one I was looking for. Most of the essays are fairly dense and not necessarily ones that would be well served by a short passage. I'm trying to see as I leaf through that, if there is anyone. Oh, there's two having to do with Robert Shaw, Robert Gould Shaw, the Boston, I think he was in his mid-20s, a young Boston man who became colonel of the 54th Regiment, which was an entirely African-American regiment, the first to serve on the Union side in the Civil War. It was the basis, much in the last 10 or 15 years, of the movie Glory. And in 1897, it was the subject of a bas-relief by Augustus St. Gaudens in Boston Common. And this particular article talks about how it appeared at the time and how it appears now, because it was greatly damaged when a underground parking garage was being built in the 1950s. And much further on in the book, there's an essay about Robert Lowell's poem for the Union Dead, which is based essentially on him looking at the South Boston Aquarium. That's how it starts, but mostly looking at St. Gaudens' memorial to Shaw and the 54th Regiment. So now there you get essentially the same subject possibly looked at in four different ways. The first was what actually happened to Shaw and his men in the Civil War. Shaw was killed in one of the very first battles they entered. The second would be St. Gaudens' bas-relief and the reaction to it. The third would be Lowell's poem, which I consider one of his three or four best. And the fourth probably is the movie Glory. In the same way, you get snapshots again and again of one space or another, one occurrence at another. I just opened the book at random and see 1950, November 28th, a Jackson Pollock exhibition opens at Betty Parsons Gallery in New York. And then right after that, 1951, Frank O'Hara takes a job as a sales clerk at the Museum of Modern Art. And immediately after that, The Catcher in the Rye. And immediately after that, From Here to Eternity. Some of the years, like 1951, has a huge number of things occurring in them. The next one is Flannery O'Connor is diagnosed with lupus. There are other periods where nothing happens for quite a few years. I think I will. The book just fell open at this point, page 852, and since it looks like I'm probably not going to get to talk to Greil Marcus, I'm going to read the beginning of 1955, August 11, Zora Neale Hurston denounces Brown versus the Board of Education. In August of 1955, Zora Neale Hurston wrote to the Orlando Sentinel, her local newspaper, attacking one of the most important legal decisions on race relations in American history. A well-known American novelist, folklorist, journalist, and anthropologist, with a sassy, ironic voice and deep powers of observation and description, Hurston had been a star of the Harlem Renaissance. In her 30-year writing career, she had adhered to the unofficial Harlem maxim of fighting for civil rights by copyright. She had always written from a place in which black humanity was assumed and black culture and creativity revered. She disdained the elitism and cultural condescension of some of the new Negro movement's architects. Hurston was an educated, modern, sophisticated woman. Raised in a small, all-black town, she made a way out of no way, moving from the swamps of Central Florida to Baltimore, Washington, securing an education at Morgan Academy and Howard University, and New York City. She won scholarships and awards that enabled her to work in New Orleans, Haiti, and Honduras. So why then, after a lifetime spent documenting and demonstrating the richness of black culture, insisting on black equality in a nation where legal and social segregation of blacks and whites was taken for granted, would Hurston decry a court decision that unanimously ruled segregation in public education unconstitutional and set the stage for the civil rights movement? As Hurston made clear in her letter to the Orlando Sentinel editor, the whole matter revolves around the self-respect of my people. That Hurston had a specific and even unique view of self-respect is revealed in the question she asks next. How much satisfaction can I get from a court order for someone to associate with me who does not wish me near them? From her point of view, the Brown decision was an insult because it decreed that there was a fundamental hierarchical difference between black and white education and perhaps culture, a difference that in her opinion and experience was absolutely specious. But if there are adequate Negro schools and prepared instructors and instruction, she wrote, then there's nothing different except the presence of white people. What was at issue in the Brown decision was not racial pride as she had defined and lived it, making the utmost of what life has dealt you, but rather an issue of social and economic justice, an adherence to the principle of the Constitution. She was writing from her own experience, seeking her own judgment, as if her world narrowed at its end, causing her to think of her remarkable life as the rule rather than the exception. That is a result, ironically, of Hurston's originality as a racial thinker and writer. From an early age, she made a commitment not to join what she called the sobbing school of Negrohood. Instead, she saw herself among the Negroes without self-pity, as she titled a 1943 essay. In 1955, in a response to Brown versus Board of Education, Hurston focused on questions of character, rather than those of systematic inequality, presaging later black critics of affirmative action. One of the most controversial statements ever made by an African-American intellectual, Hurston's opinion in the Sentinel affected her legacy indelibly, as it seemed to confirm charges of conservatism leveled at her earlier by contemporaries such as Richard Wright. Hurston's work eventually fell into obscurity until it was famously championed by Alice Walker in the 1970s. While Hurston's politics in general took a definite right turn in later life, her racial thinking was somewhat atypical from the start. Her upbringing in Eatonville, Florida, all the days spent on the porch of the all-black town's general store, instilled in her a sense of racial well-being rather than a sense of deficit. A pure Negro town, charter, mayor, council, town marshal, and all, Eatonville was for the most part self-sufficient, independent. In her words, a burly, boiling, hard-hitting, rugged, individualistic setting. Filled with a spirit of black pride and self-determination, Hurston did not feel tragically colored. In fact, she did not feel herself to be colored at all until her mother's death, when Hurston was 13, forced her to leave Eatonville and to leave behind as well her previous sense of herself, as in some ways unraced. As she explains in How It Feels to Be Colored Me, Hurston left Eatonville as Zora and arrived in Jacksonville as a little colored girl. That's just the beginning of one of the essays, I think one of the most impressive in this huge compendium, A New Literary History of America, edited by Greil Marcus and Werner Solors. It was published last fall by Harvard University Press, and as I said, it was my first contact with it was a rather negative one when Boston Globe columnist Alex Bean called it wacky and then just gave me a copy, I guess because he didn't need it anymore. I've enjoyed it thoroughly over the last 6 months, maybe years before I've read the whole thing, but I know I'm going to dip into it every now and then for a good period. As I said at the beginning of the program, I had hoped to talk with Greil Marcus this afternoon. I did talk to him about an hour and a half ago and called back twice at the beginning of the program and got a somewhat disguised answering machine. It sounded like his voice, but it was a different name, and I think he's in hiding. He said he was working on something else when I first talked to him, and that may have taken priority. In any case, I'm glad to recommend his book. Many people may know him as a rock critic. He wrote for Rolling Stone in its heyday in the 60s, 70s, and so on, and got best known perhaps for his cultural study of early rockers centering around Elvis Presley called Mystery Train. He's got another book on American culture called Lipstick Traces and several others since then. Werner Solors, I don't know except that he's the author of Neither Black Nor White Yet Both and Ethnic Modernism, and he's a professor of English Literature and African and American Studies at Harvard. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be back in a very short time, I hope, with Professor Jerome Loving to talk about his new biography of Mark Twain. And we're back with Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you till 2 p.m. In the second half of the program, I'm going to be talking with Jerome Loving, who's Distinguished Professor of English at Texas A&M University. He's previously written biographies of Walt Whitman called The Song of Himself and The Last Titan, A Life of Theodore Dreiser, both of which were published by the University of California Press, and he's just come out with a new biography of Mark Twain called Mark Twain, The Adventures of Samuel L. Clemens. Welcome to Booktown, Professor Loving.
Well, thank you.
I guess one of the first questions anybody would wonder is, there have probably been as many biographies about Mark Twain as anybody in American history, except perhaps maybe Abraham Lincoln. Why another one?
Well, every biographer, when he writes a biography, that's the first question people ask. What's new? In my case, I'm a specialist in American literature, and Mark Twain has never really received a biography that thoroughly discussed in any original way his life in tandem with his works. This is what's known as a critical biography. And it's hard to do and make it still interesting, but I hope I have, because his life was so interesting itself, so episodical, that it was kind of easy to do, to interweave the life and the work. So that was That was one reason. There have been 5,000, I think, letters discovered since Justin Kaplan's award-winning biography of Mark Twain in the 1960s. And also, it's the 100th anniversary of the death of Mark Twain, April 21st. So it seemed like a good idea about 5 or 6 years ago.
And the University of California is the home of the biggest trove of Mark Twain-related papers. So I guess it would make sense that you publish through the UC Press.
Well, there wasn't a direct connection because I'd done biographies on Whitman, as you said, and Dreiser. But when I did come to Twain, it did make a lot of sense because the Mark Twain Project is at Berkeley, and it's also the Mark Twain Project and the Mark Twain they issue books. I forget what the P stands for in this case right now. But at any rate, at that archive, they have every known letter, a copy of every known letter that Mark Twain ever wrote, as well as letters to him. So it's the place to go if you're going to write a life of Mark Twain.
And I think you mentioned when I talked to you earlier that some of these letters have never been published.
Well, not in any uniform fashion. The one project at the project is the publication of the letters, but so far they have only published 6 volumes covering letters from the early 1850s up to 1876. There's another seventh volume that's being done, and some of those are available online. Otherwise, any letters after that are scattered in all sorts of books about Mark Twain, which would make the job much more difficult. But if you go out there, they're right there. And he wrote a lot of letters after 1880. So he had 30 more years to live.
Although he was never had much in the way of formal schooling, he was one of those people who seemed not to be able to not write. He was always writing letters. He started writing sketches for newspapers when he was, I think, 16?
Yes, right around 16, that's right, yeah. He wrote for his brother's newspaper in Hannibal, Missouri. Many of the writers that came to importance in the 19th century really didn't have that much schooling. Walt Whitman had a sixth grade education. That's approximately what Mark Twain had. But they were readers and writers. And writers who write cannot help but to do it constantly.
And one of the things, most interesting things, when you go through the various versions of his famous and not so famous pieces, is how often he might be working on 6 or 7 projects at the same time, or he'd work on one for a week, then drop it, work on another for a month, and so on. And he frequently would take sections from one work and move them over into another.
Yes, he used to say that he would run out of gas on a particular manuscript, so he'd go to another. After he wrote Tom Sawyer, which was published in 1876, people really were anxious for the sequel, and he started not long after that to write a sequel, which became Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. But he actually published 3 other books in the interim, just because it's like having pots on a stove, and he would turn to one or the other, and then this would affect the ultimate one, in this case Huckleberry Finn, because The Prince and the Pauper, there's a mix of identities, just as there are in Huckleberry Finn. So there's a lot of chance in literary genius, and Mark Twain himself considered himself not only an artist but a businessman, and these books primarily he wanted to make money. He published only almost exclusively throughout his career by subscription publishing, which meant orders had to be given before books were printed. And finally, he founded his own publishing company himself. But he was primarily in the market to make money. And when he wrote Huckleberry Finn, he He almost tossed it off as simply another work. He didn't quite realize that this was his magnum opus, and one of the great classics of American and world literature.
A lot of people are familiar with the conflict within him as being seen as a humorist or wanting to be taken as a more serious writer. You point out, in addition to that, that he really started out as a travel writer, in a sense, and that it was only after he'd been writing for quite a few years that he really started imaginative fiction.
Well, he actually started as a humorist, a newspaper humorist. And there's a dual role in the humorist of the 19th century, because you can write standard English, but you want to write in the vernacular or the tongue of your semi-literate characters. And so what the humorists would do, they would put a literary frame around the work where they'd introduce it by standard English, and then a character would come in and tell the story. So right there you've got a play of two kinds of writers, which might correspond with Mark Twain and Samuel Langhorne Clemens, you know, the usual trinomial, three-legged author name in the 19th century. But Twain, he told his brother he was probably called upon to make God's creatures laugh. But ultimately, that idea, the humor, there's another side to humor. If we're surprised, you know, the basis of humor is incongruity. The unexpected comes along, and so ultimately, he wanted to write more serious work. He probably didn't realize right away that he was doing that in Huckleberry Finn. Of course, he was, but his own family, who were very much typically Victorian in their tastes, wanted him to write like Henry James or his own friend, very good friend, William Dean House. Something he could do quite well, and which he did in The Prince and the Pauper, and also in his reminiscences of Joan of Arc, which came out about in the 1890s. So, but they wanted him to write as it were. But the real writing, of course, came out of the humorist of the Old Southwest. It's said that Mark Twain is the culmination of the humor of the Old Southwest, and that culminates in Huckleberry Finn, which is funny, which is told by a 14 or 15-year-old, but which is deadly serious in its themes, ultimately.
And that's the one book in which he, or the first book in which he completely got rid of the straight narrator frame.
Exactly.
He just started straight out with Huck's voice and went with it all the way.
I don't think anyone's fully explained why he did that when he was being urged to go the other way by his family and perhaps others. Humorists were not—they weren't that highly respected. It was said that the humorists were writers of the left hand, and so there was a certain prejudice against them that if you could get out of that paradigm, that it'd be a good idea. But what Twain did ultimately, he combined the humor, and in his last book, which is known as not really, he didn't finish it, but we call it The Mysterious Stranger Manuscripts. Life is a joke, a cosmic joke in a way, and the entertainer there is the devil, or actually the nephew of the devil, who does tricks for Huck and Tom and things like that, but ultimately says there is no world, no God, no this, no that. It's all been a joke. And this is probably the Mark Twain, this is the Mark Twain, of course, at the near the end of his career, one who would also pen a work which he didn't dare publish then, called 3,000 Years Among the Microbes, where, unlike in the Connecticut Yankee, where the person wakes up in the 6th century, this narrator wakes up as a microbe in the body of a town drunk. Suggests man's relation to God.
You mentioned that when he was very young, one of the questions his mother remembered, or he remembered asking her, was why people weren't more sympathetic toward Satan.
Yes, in a way, that's kind of a joke, but And I think he probably got his humor initially from his mother. I think I have it in the book that he was born 2 months prematurely, and he was a sickly child. And Mark Twain says at one point, "Weren't you worried that I was going to die?" And she thought a minute. She said, "No, I was afraid you were going to live." That's pretty funny.
Yes.
And your mother says that, even if she could say it with a in a droll way, but. So I think because his father was a picture we have is rather morose. He was unsuccessful, as was Orion, Mark Twain's older brother. The grandfather was killed in an accident. So he really came out of a long tradition of failure. And then he became so world famous and so rich and then almost poor again. But, you know, he was probably the most famous person on the planet when he died.
But by that time, he was quite bitter, and...
Well, he was bitter, but he knew that we were all, God's fools, if you will. Another term he used somewhere. But he kept it in perspective. I think the idea that the deep, deep pessimism is a little bit over argued. For instance, I mean, they say, well, he since his daughter died and his wife died, he thought the universe was against him, and he personalized things. But I think he absorbed all those things too. He could still write about it, right up to the end. Letters from the Earth, one of the last things he did. So, so that might be overemphasized somewhat.
You divide your book into four sections: humorist in the West, writer in the East, the artist and the businessman, and then the mysterious stranger, which you talked about a few minutes ago. But all through the book, you keep talking about this stranger motif.
Yes, well, I mean, what I'm trying to get at there, I guess, is, in a metaphoric way, is to explain the humor, the basis of the humor, which is ultimately tragedy. What is it they say? Tragedy plus time equals comedy, something like that. When I write biographies, I try not to get a thesis. I remember everyone asked me with the Whitman biography, what was your thesis? And I thought I really didn't have one. If I had one, it was sort of subconsciously manipulated through the book. But with Twain, I had the idea of the mysterious stranger, like in the Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. Someone the stranger comes into town and pulls the rug out from under your intentions in one way or another.
And then you point that out again and again in one book after another.
Yeah, I tried to get that in my title, actually.
They wouldn't take it.
It didn't work.
Now, you mentioned your two other subjects, or you mentioned Whitman, and I said earlier, you've written about him and Dreiser, and you bring them up actually almost as if with Mark Twain they form the great vernacular writers of the late 19th, early 20th century.
Well, I saw that as sort of a trilogy, that these writers did write in the vernacular. Whitman wrote, unlike his, the schoolroom poets of New England before him, he wrote about sex and jobs, and Dreiser wrote about common people that give in to their appetites. And, Twain wrote about an illiterate 14-year-old that really showed us the world. But there's more to that. Vernacular, is a synonym, perhaps, with democracy. These are the democratic writers, the ones who brought out the themes of the American people, who broke more dramatically with the English models. And I just saw this as the trilogy idea wasn't there originally. It came to me as I came to Mark Twain. I realized that what all three of these writers had in common.
You had said at the several points that you thought that his humor came not only from his mother, and you just mentioned possibly in reaction to his somewhat stiff father and older brother, that there was the part of him that wanted riches and respectability, but there was a part of him that just could not stand hierarchy and authority and pretentiousness.
Well, I'm not sure about the second point. Certainly in the first part, he wanted to be rich all of his life. And my theory is that when he was about that impressionable age of 12 or 13 in Hannibal, the gold rush of 1849 took place. And people were passing through Hannibal, leaving Hannibal. His own school teacher left, all to get rich in California. And then when Twain, when he was 18, in his 20s, he was going to go to South America to get rich. And on that, there, then he became a steamboat pilot. Till the war broke that up, then his brother got this job as secretary to the territorial governor of Nevada. So he went out west with him, and he became a silver miner and a gold miner. He wanted to strike it rich there. Then he struck it rich with his pen. And then he was always trying to invent things. In fact, one of his inventions, the self-pasting scrapbook, made him $50,000. But most of them were failures. And finally, he got into that page typesetter and lost today's equivalent of millions of dollars. And he really, truly wanted to be rich.
And as we said before, he did want the respect that a serious author rather than just a humorist would get, but he couldn't help poking fun at the English and at nobility and most people with pretensions, everyone.
Certainly, English nobility was one of his key ideas. You have the Duke and Dauphine and Huckleberry Finn, for example. All Americans kind of, we don't like aristocracy, and yet we wonder, gee, do we go back anywhere? Twain's mother said that they went back to their old Durham, and the father said they hoped for something. That Twain never believed it, but he used all these things in his fiction.
And especially in something like Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court.
Which was very hard on the English.
Yes.
Yeah. He originally went over to England in the early 70s to write a book about the English, a jovial book. And they were so nice to him, and they gave him so much hospitality and everything, he couldn't do it. But he ultimately turned to writing two books that the English didn't particularly like very much. One set 16th century England, the other in 6th century.
Another point that you make that I had not really thought about, although I probably should have, my first experience of Mark Twain, when I was somewhere around 8 or 10, my grandparents gave me matched copies of Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. And at that time, I read Tom Sawyer easily and enjoyed it, but couldn't get into Huck Finn. But a lot of the way I imagined both books was from the illustrations, which were by Norman Rockwell, and certainly had a very distinct cast to them. Now, you mentioned that a lot of his books, in many of his books, the illustrations are very important, and most modern editions omit them completely.
Yeah, and that's too bad, because E.W. Kemble did some wonderful ones for Huckleberry Finn, and there were some marvelous ones done by, I can't remember the man's name right offhand, for the Connecticut Yankee, almost really like political cartoons. I guess the illustrations come, though, from Twain. He started out writing, he wasn't sure when he wrote Tom Sawyer whether it was a children's book or an adult book, so illustrations seemed to be in order, and I think that's how things got started that way. And anyhow, subscription presses catered more to the common interest, and illustrations couldn't hurt there as well.
The one example you give in the book that is really startling, almost shocking, is two sets of illustrations for close to this, I guess the same scene from Pudd'nhead Wilson, in which Roxy is 1/16 African American, but because of that, she's still considered black and is still can be enslaved.
As Twain says, the one vote outvoted all the others.
Yeah,
a slave.
And in one picture, she's depicted as looking like a very genteel woman of the 1830s, and in the other, which I guess replaced it.
Very white.
Yeah, and the other, she is the worst caricature of a plantation black.
Yes, which doesn't go with the story at all. But in you know, what, 6 brief years, the book was first published, I believe, by American Publishing Company, the subscription publisher he'd used all the years. But then they sold all these books to Harper, Harper Brothers. And by 1900, Reconstruction had closed down in 1877. The lynchings had started. I think there were over 2,500 lynchings between 1880 and 1920. I don't think anyone was ever prosecuted for them. So, I mean, the Jim Crowism and everything. So I guess the publisher just took a certain liberty. Twain himself, there's no better argument against slavery than Huckleberry Finn. But remember, Twain was born in the South, went west, and ended up living in the East,
about slavery, how his attitudes changed.
During the lynchings, he wrote an essay called "The United States of Lynchardom," and he was going to put it in Harper's Magazine and then maybe publish a book, and they said, "You don't want to publish that. You'll lose your Southern readership." And he'd just come out of bankruptcy, and he worried about his family, and so he didn't do it, sadly.
You mentioned that he didn't think of Huckleberry Finn as his greatest work, although he may have had some feelings that way toward the end of his life. You clearly do. He thought of the personal reminiscences of Joan of Arc as his best piece, and hardly anyone reads that these days. How would you rate his works?
No, I'd put Huckleberry Finn at the top, and I might probably put Joan of Arc at the near the bottom. But he follows the facts pretty closely. There's, of course, not an ounce of humor in it. The family liked the story, and he thought of Susie, who seemed to be a martyr in many ways, and he thought of her. And then, of course, Joan is like Huck in one sense, because she's an innocent, almost an unrealistic innocent in a hard world. He said that he liked that book best, but on other occasions he conceded that Huckleberry Finn was probably his best book. That, you know, later on, not after he'd just written it, but 10, 15 years later, when it started being recognized in the 90s by British critics and others as the fine book it was. And that kiss kept growing and growing. By the time he died, it was a pretty famous book.
What others would you put toward the top?
I put Ned Wilson for its just amazing plot, and its condemnation of slavery. Roughing It. A lot of his short platform pieces came out of that. Innocence Abroad. That was the first travel book that really challenged this idea that Europe was superior to America, and that Americans should be, meek and respectful when they go over there. And of course, he goes over there and they see a mummy, and one of the tourists says, "Is he dead?" And, all sorts of disrespectful things to kind of turn everything around.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time, and I'm very pleased to have talked to you. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City, and I've been talking with Jerome Loving, Distinguished Professor of English at Texas A&M University, about Mark Twain, The Adventures of Samuel L. Clemens. University of California Press says it's not officially published, but they say it is available.
No, it is published. It was published officially March 11th.
Aha. Okay, the date I had was a little later. I'm glad to hear that.
We were shooting for April 21st, but anyhow, thanks very much, Eric.
Okay. This has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Thome, and I'm getting out of here so you can listen to Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.